This morning we're going to read and study Paul's letter to the Ephesians, chapter 5, verses 1 to 20. Therefore be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. But immorality and all impurity and covetousness must not even be named among you, as is fitting among saints. Let there be no filthiness, nor silly talk, nor levity, which are not fitting, but instead let there be thanksgiving. Be sure of this, that no immoral or impure man or one who is covetous, that is, an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for it is because of these things that the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore do not associate with them, for once you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of the light. For the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. And try to learn what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is a shame even to speak of the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. For anything that becomes visible is light. Therefore it is said, "Awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give you light." Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of the time, because the days are evil. Therefore do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. And do not get drunk with wine, for that is debauchery, but be filled with the Spirit, addressing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody to the Lord with all your heart, always and for everything, giving thanks in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ to God the Father. Before we study that, we'll sing 560. Walk in the light, and thou shalt own thy darkness passed away. 560.
Thy darkness passed away.
It's a very thrilling moment when a baby is born, but there are certain milestones afterwards which stand out as great moments also. One is when the baby begins to talk, but I think one of the most exciting is when a baby begins to walk. Those few faltering steps, with the parent wanting to hold the baby and yet holding back because you want them to walk, and their first few steps are taken. You remember that day, some of you parents, the day when your baby began to walk. Now the same is true of spiritual babies. It's thrilling when a soul is born again and someone becomes a Christian and begins the new life. It's even more thrilling when they begin to walk. And to walk means to take one step after another in the right direction. It's as simple as that. Walking is not very spectacular, but it's very healthy. Most of us can walk further than we can run. And if we walk, we are doing something that is good for us and that will get us somewhere. Now, Watchman Nee, the great Chinese Christian now in prison for the Lord's sake, has written a study of Paul's letter to the Ephesians, and he's called it Sit, Walk, Stand. And these are the three things that Paul tells you to do in the letter to the Ephesians. In chapter 1, he says, God has made us sit with Christ in the heavenly places. That's where you sit now. You may think you're sitting on a more comfortable pew in the New Millmead Center, but you remember that when we dealt with this chapter, this was in the old building. And I said then you weren't even sitting in Commercial Road, you're sitting in heaven. That's where you sit spiritually. Your body may be here, but your spirit sits in heaven. But your body is still on earth and your body can walk. And so Paul, having said that's where you sit, now you must learn to walk. And then at the end of Ephesians in chapter 6, which we'll reach in a few weeks' time, he says, when you're in the battle, you must stand. So the Christian must learn three things: how to sit, how to walk, and how to stand. And the word walk occurs three times in the passage I've just read for you. It's there in chapter 5, verse 2, walk in love. It's there in verse 8, walk as children of the light. It's there in verse 15, walk not as unwise men, but as wise. And there are three things to learn if you're going to walk the Christian life. Now let me just deal with two temptations first. One temptation is that once you've become a Christian and sat down with Christ in heavenly places, the temptation is to go on sitting and do nothing more. And you never get anywhere, you don't make progress. Yes, you're safe, you're sitting in heaven, but that's all. The other temptation with young Christians is to want to run before they can walk. To want to do something pretty spectacular for God. To want to do something great, something startling. And yet God just wants you to learn to walk. Just to move forward steadily in the right direction. And we'd so love to run. Maybe you will one day, but learn to walk first or you'll come a cropper if you try to run. Now the three things you need to learn if you're going to walk the Christian life are these. You need to learn the principle of imitation. Of imitation. Secondly, the principle of illumination. And third, the principle of intoxication. And these three together lead to a good walk in the Lord. The first of all is the principle of imitation. Most of the things we learn in life, we learn through imitating others. Most of the habits we pick up from other people. And when you are young, there is a tremendous pressure on you to imitate other people, to go with the crowd, to do what everybody else does, to conform. Now, you don't want to conform to the elders when you're young, but how you want to conform to the young when you're young. And so you imitate. Little children imitate their elders. Teenagers imitate their contemporaries, but we're all imitating. Now that's not a bad thing, provided you're imitating the right people. And above all, imitating the right person. Every one of us is going to be a mimic in one way or another, and the Greek word Paul uses here is mimic. Therefore, be mimics of God. Somebody said that Christians should be practicing to be God. And there's something in this. In other words, who are you going to imitate in life? Paul says, set your sights for your imitation on the very highest person you know. Don't imitate other people. but be imitators of God. Seek to copy Him. Seek to live like Him. Now the sad thing is that if you imitate others, you are imitating those whom Paul calls children or sons of disobedience. And if you imitate other people, sooner or later you'll find yourself disobeying God, because other people do this. And if you imitate them, you will disobey God also. There are some pretty horrible words used now, nasty words that have a horrible smell about them. First three are concerned with immorality, impurity, covetousness. If you imitate others, sooner or later you will do these things, and so will I. Immorality, the word means quite literally sex outside marriage. But the interesting thing about this word is that the root meaning of the word is to sell, to sell. It means to treat people as things, to treat people as commodities who can be bought and sold. And it's a very interesting word. The basic meaning of immorality is to treat people as things. Do you find it interesting that most of the slang words that young people use for members of the opposite sex treat people as less than people? Just to give you one example alone, to call a girl a bird is to say you're not a human being, you're just a creature. You're no more than that little bird on the tree to me. And I feel I can do with a bird what I want. I'm over nature. That's what you're saying. And if you study language, so often it turns out that we are treating each other as things and not as people to be loved. And that is precisely what is wrong with sex outside marriage. It is treating people as things, as commodities. And that's the first word used. The second word needs no definition. It means quite simply dirt. Dirt. Treating each other as things and treating each other as dirt. And the third word, covetousness, again needs no definition. Phillips translates it with this phrase, grabbing anything you want, or the itch to get your hands on what belongs to other people. Now, why does Paul link together immorality, impurity, and covetousness? The answer is very simple. All three of them are self-indulgence. All three of them are living to grab, to get, to be greedy for what I want. That's the thread that ties those three things together. And Paul is saying that is what will happen if you imitate other people. Now then he goes on to a second group of three words, filthiness, silly talk, and levity. And the reason he goes on to this is very simple. He knows that most of us begin not by doing these things, but by talking about them. And that if you allow these things to creep into your words, it will not be long before they creep into your deeds. Now this is certainly true at school. Cast your mind back to your school days. Before you did anything wrong, you talked about it and you joked about it with the others at school. That's how it started. And long before you did anything, you were talking about it. And so Paul says these three things. Kenneth Taylor translates it like this: dirty stories, foul talk, and coarse jokes. Now, you may never have done certain things, but Paul is saying even talking about them is the first step and leads to that. Now, what effect do these things have on our lives? Paul says, don't let anyone deceive you with empty words, plausible arguments, clever speech. They do affect your life. Far from gaining something through these things, you will lose something through these things. Let no one deceive you. You can't do these things and not lose. So don't be deceived by plausible arguments about freedom. Don't give way to the power of propaganda. As Billy Graham has said very cogently, the new morality is simply the old immorality dressed up. Don't let anyone deceive you. Two things are affected by these things: our future and our father. Our future is affected that those who do such things have no inheritance in the kingdom of God and of Christ. That means two things. It means one thing for the unbeliever, it means another thing for the believer. The unbeliever won't have a place in heaven through these things. The believer won't have a reward in heaven through these things. So either way, there is no inheritance in the kingdom of God and of Christ. Don't let anybody fool you. Don't let anybody tell you that you won't lose by these things, that you can do them and get away with it. There is no inheritance. Your future is affected and lost through this. Now the second thing that's affected, not a thing but a person, our Father is affected. And Paul makes it quite clear that it is this kind of thing that makes our Father angry. It is because of these things that the wrath of God comes on the sons of disobedience. Therefore, don't let anybody say it doesn't affect anybody else what you do with your life. It affects your future. It affects your Father in heaven. And it makes him angry. Now, what's the alternative? The alternative is to say, I'm not going to imitate other people. I'm going to imitate God. I'm going to copy him. I'm going to model my life on his. What will happen then? Instead of disobedience, your life will be a life of love. Imitators of God and walk in love. Walking is not very spectacular. It will be just one step at a time, as I've said. And love is concerned not with one big grand gesture, but with one step after another of loving people. Now, I've told you that the thing that ties together immorality, impurity, and covetousness is the desire to grab and to get. If you imitate God, your desire will be the opposite, a desire to give. No longer in terms of getting, but of giving. No longer in terms of selfishness, but of sacrifice. Be imitators of God and walk in love as Christ loved you and gave himself as a sacrifice. That's the kind of life that follows if you imitate God. God is not a God who grabs, he's a God who gives. God is not a God who says, how can I enjoy myself? What do I want? What can I take? God is a God who says, I love people. What can I give them? What can I give them next? What can I give up for them? I could give up my only son. And he did. And this is the life to which we are called if we're going to walk as we ought. It's a life that is a mimic of God. A life that is a copy of God. You notice that he says, be imitators of God as beloved children. I will tell you this. The more a child is loved, the more that child will imitate the one who loves them. Love is what makes children imitate. If a child does not love an elder, or is not loved by them, they are not so likely to imitate them. But if you're loved by someone, if you were loved by your parents, you wanted to be like them. And unconsciously, you assimilated their pattern of life. Without realizing it, you began to mimic them. Have you ever seen a little boy swaggering down the road with a group of older boys trying to be like them? Coughing as he smokes his first cigarette because he's wanting to imitate them and be big. Have you ever watched a little boy walking down the road with his father when his father loves him, taking long strides to be like daddy? See the difference? Imitators of God as beloved children, walking in his footsteps. There's a nasty smell about some of the words I mentioned here, but God says if you walk in love, then like Christ you will be to God a fragrant perfume. God has a sense of smell, and he loves a sweet smell, and love smells good to God. Now let's look at the second principle, the principle of illumination. If you're going to walk properly, you'll need to walk in the light. Somebody tried walking in the dark last night and walked through our front door, right here. And you've seen the broken glass. They weren't hurt, but the glass was. But they were walking in darkness. That's why they did it. And the second principle is this. If you're going to walk properly, you need to walk in light. You need to see where you're going. You need to cast light around you. A dark path is a dangerous path. And Paul says quite simply, the things of which I've been speaking are darkness. And you can't walk straight in the darkness. Do you know that most of us, if we walked in the dark, would walk in circles? I'm told that it's because one of our legs is usually stronger than the other, especially if you're a driver. But we all tend to walk in circles. One minister up in the Shetland Islands, I remember, 21 years ago, went out in a snowstorm, and he walked around in circles for 3 hours. Fortunately, they found him. He thought he was heading somewhere, but he wasn't. He just walked round in circles for 3 hours. He couldn't see. He was walking in darkness. It was late at night, and he just walked in circles. Now, Paul says there is an association between good and light and evil and darkness. It's interesting that most sin is committed at night, because men don't like the light. They prefer the darkness because their deeds are evil. And so they don't live during the day as God intended us to live. They go in for night life, which is against God's pattern. And God gave the day to live and to work and the night to sleep. Of course, there are those who have to work at night today, but I'm not talking about those now. Now, you notice that Paul doesn't say, you used to be in the dark. He said, you used to be darkness. He doesn't say, you are now in the light. He says, you are now light. It's not that you were in darkness or in light. You were darkness, or you are light. And that means that every one of us is either making this world a darker place or a lighter place. We can't help it. We are changing the degree of light in the world, all of us. So we are either darkness, making the world a darker place, or we're light, lighting it up a bit. Now let's look at the two things. Darkness, he says there are two things about darkness. Number one, it is unfruitful. Number two, it is unmentionable. Number one, it is unfruitful. Darkness never produces anything. It is the light that produces something. You can plant the seeds in your garden, but it's the light that's needed to produce something from them. Darkness doesn't produce anything. It's negative. It kills. Light produces. It's fruitful. Darkness has nothing to show for it. And if you are darkness, your life will have nothing to show for it at the end. Nothing at all. Unproductive. Unfruitful. It is also unmentionable. When we are darkness, there are things that we cannot talk about. It would be a shame, it would be a disgrace, it would be embarrassing even to talk about them, says Paul. They are unmentionable. Whereas the things that are done in the light can be talked about, can be part of conversation, but not darkness. Now look at the light. The New English Bible translates this beautifully. Live like men who are at home in daylight. That's a lovely phrase. Live like men who are at home in daylight. Some people have got such a hangover from the night before that when the sun rises, they have to screw their eyes up. They're not at home in daylight. They'll just try and get through the day somehow so that when the darkness comes, they can go back to their life. They're like the creatures that only come out at night. Live like men who are at home in the daylight. Then you'll be fruitful. Light produces growing, ripening fruit. All that's good and right and true, that's what's meant by fruitfulness here. If you're going to produce what's good and right and true, you need to live in the light. As a plant needs to be in the sunlight to produce its fruit, you need to be in the light also. Now the basic question is this. What does light do about darkness? For in this world we've got light and darkness side by side. There are lovely, good, right and true things in the world. There are horrible things as well. And they live side by side. They mix. What is the attitude of light to darkness? There are two things mentioned here. One that must be done and one that mustn't be done. Let's make it quite clear which is which. Number one, do not associate with those in darkness. Do not associate. Now that doesn't mean don't have any contact with them. They will never be saved if you have no contact. The word associate means to have regular company with. And quite simply, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. Nothing could be clearer. A Christian cannot afford to be associated in regular company with those in darkness. He may do it with the best motives in the world. He may say, I'm going in to try and win them. He may say, I'm going to influence them for good. But if he's regularly in company with darkness, then he's laying himself open to something the Bible tells him is too much for him. Contact, yes. Company, no. And your company will decide so much whether you live in light or in darkness. It is very important that a Christian spends much time in company with other Christians. Very important. Do not associate with them, but rather expose them. Now, here I'm afraid I'm going to come down quite heavily on the side of the translation I read, which is, but instead expose them. The Authorized Version has rather rebuke or reprove them, as if you must go and tell them they are doing wrong. And some Christians have therefore been led into, I believe, a misguided ministry at this point. Paul tells us quite definitely that it is not up to us to judge the outsider. God will judge them. We are rather to expose them. Now, what does that mean? That we have a protest parade and talk about them loudly? Paul here is talking about light, and light comes to the eye rather than the ear. He is talking about lives rather than lips, and the word is expose. And he says they will be exposed by light. The simple fact is that if there are secret things going on in darkness, the only thing you need to do is to switch a light on. You don't need to say anything. Switch the light on and it's exposed. Who was it who said, I'd rather light a candle than curse the darkness? A very appropriate saying for just now. I'd rather light a candle than curse the darkness. And Paul is talking about light that can be seen, not heard. He's saying expose. It's a photographic word almost, except that photography was not known to Paul. But what does the word expose mean? In photography, it means let the light shine, let it in. And the thing is changed when the light comes in. It's been exposed. And Jesus said, let your light shine before men that they may see. Not hear, that they may see. And when they see your goodness, they will see their badness, because light has this double effect. It exposes as well as shines. And so Paul says, let your light shine. Now, how can you let your light shine? The answer is you have no light of your own, but light has a peculiar quality. Everything light strikes becomes light. That's what Paul says here. I think it's translated here. When anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. I think it'd almost be better to say anything is exposed to the light, it becomes light. That's the literal translation. The moon shines there on a dark night, and it exposes so much on the earth. But the moon has no light of its own at all. It's just a big ball of metal and dust. Where does it get its light? From the sun. But because the sun is shining on the moon is able to shine on the earth and expose the earth. And a bright moon can expose a great deal on earth. There were even some South Sea Islanders who worshipped the moon rather than the sun, on the principle that the moon came out at night when it was needed, but the sun only shone during the day when it was light anyway. And that was their principle. Poor little souls, they didn't realize that the moon just borrowed its light from its sun. We are to Jesus what the moon is to the sun, and we are to be to the earth what the moon is to the earth. And therefore it says, awake, O sleeper, and rise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. Which means if you weren't a sleepy Christian or even a dead Christian, the light of Christ would shine on you, and that would reflect into your environment, and you would expose the world in its darkness to the light of Christ. Now that's the picture here. And that little quotation, it doesn't come from the Old Testament, doesn't come from the New Testament. Clearly it's a quotation. Where did Paul get it from? It seems, from all we can discover, that it's one of the earliest Christian hymns, probably sung at baptismal services in the early church. Arise, O sleeper, awake. Wake up, you Christian. Wake up. Don't be dead. Wake up and Christ will give you light. Then let that light shine and you will expose the darkness. So walk in the light. reach up to the sunlight, and you do that by seeking to learn what is pleasing to the Lord, says Paul. That's reaching after the sunlight. Seek to learn what pleases Him. Don't try to please yourself. Don't even try to please others. You never will. But seek to please the Lord. And then you're reaching up to the light, and He will give you light, and it will shine, and others will be exposed without a word. We need more Christians shining in Britain. I don't think we need more Christians shouting. I think we need more Christians shining. Now let's move on to the third principle of walking. Intoxication. If you want to get to walk straight, you need to get intoxicated. Now that may sound really wrong, but Paul says this here. Not with alcohol, but with God. And so he says, don't get drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. Funnily enough, to be intoxicated with God, you can walk straight. If you get drunk with wine, that's the one thing you'll never manage. A preacher called Welsh was once preaching on this text, do not get drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. And he began his sermon most dramatically with this sentence, you've got to fill a man with something. You've got to fill a man with something. We've had great difficulty early this week getting the pump for the baptistry going. It's going all right now. But we had real problems. We couldn't get it going. We tried everything and it just wouldn't pump water. And so we sent for the man who put it in, and he came and he said, ah, well, the pump needs priming. It's just full of air at the moment. It's got to be full of water. Then it'll start pumping. And sure enough, he got it going. Man needs priming. Otherwise, he's just full of air. He breathes, but he needs, if he's really going to get out of himself and into real life, he needs filling with something. That's why so many get drunk, and that's why so many young people are taking drugs. They know they've got to be filled with something. They know they haven't the resources within themselves for life. And so they need help. They need some stimulus. They need some resources that they haven't got. So they take drugs, or they get drunk, or they do something to get filled with something to get life. Now in those days, drink was the main way. They hadn't got many drugs in the Roman Empire, so they just took drink. And drunkenness was very frequent, but at least a man was trying to get out of himself when he got drunk. We used to say in the north that to get drunk was the quickest way out of Manchester on a Saturday night. And Manchester, in the middle of Manchester, among all the factories with drizzle in the streets, is a miserable place, and the quickest way out was to get drunk. There's only one snag with that. Paul calls it dissipation, translated here debauchery, but I think a closer English word might be dissipation. The word means wastefulness. It just throws your life away. It wastes time, it wastes money. It's foolish, it's careless, it's thoughtless, it's reckless. And above all, it just throws away what God gave you. The word means to throw something away. Don't get drunk with wine, wherein is debauchery, wherein is throwing your life away. A film was made some years ago about an alcoholic, and very significantly the film was entitled Lost Weekend. Lost Weekend. Just lost. And that is the difficulty of getting drunk. You've lost that bit of your life. You've lost it. It's gone. And drugs are doing the same for young people. They're wanting life. They know they've got to be filled with something, so they're getting high on this drug, that drug, and the other. But their life is getting lost. It's wasted. They've nothing to show for it. It's the same word that's used in Luke 15 of the prodigal son. He went to a far country. A little Sunday school boy once said to his Sunday school teacher, he wasted his substance in righteous living. But the word is not righteous, it's riotous, and it's the same word as here, in wasteful living. Soon he'd gone through all his dad's money and he'd nothing to show for it. Wasted. And those months of his life were lost. He thought he'd enjoyed it at the time, but they were lost. He'd wasted it. He could never have it back again. Now Paul says, don't get high on drugs. That's just to lose your life. It's to throw it away. but rather be wise, guided, and filled. Be wise, realize that the days are evil, so you've got to rescue each day for good. Otherwise it will just be evil and wasted and lost. So you've got to redeem the time, buy it up, seize the opportunity, get another day back for God from a life that would otherwise be wasted. That's a wise man. And secondly, seek the will of God. God has planned your life out. He knows what you can do with it. He's got a plan for your life that's just right for the length of your life. He knows how long it's going to be. And his plan is right for your life, which is just long enough to fulfill his plan, but too short to waste any of it. And so find out what the will of the Lord is. And then you don't waste your life. Tragic if you've gone after your own plans and desires for so long and suddenly wake up and realize it's all wasted and God had a plan for you that would have used your life to the best possible advantage. And finally, be filled. Verse 18 is a startling contrast and wouldn't just occur to people today. But you know, one of the things that was said to me this week about this new building when it was filled with people, and I took it as one of the greatest compliments that had been paid this church. Somebody said to me, the atmosphere coming in the front entrance was just like a public house. And I was thrilled. It's what I've longed to be said. Why do people go to the public house? Because people are relaxed and in fellowship and they're happy and there's noise and there's singing. Some people seem to want God's house to be as silent as a cemetery and think that that's honoring to God. There is a place for quietness, especially at home on your own. But oh, I was thrilled when somebody said it's just like a public house. Because I've talked to men who've said to me, I go to the public house because it's a much happier and easier place to go into than a church where everybody's so quiet and everybody's looking at the back of your head because you've got to sit in the front row, they're all in the back and it's so uncomfortable. Well, I want this place to be a public house in the truest sense of the word. And you know what's going to be needed for that? People who are drunk with God. Because they will not lose control of themselves then, but certain things will happen that happen in a public house. Tongues are loosened, feelings are released, song comes out. And so Paul says, don't get drunk with wine, but do be filled with the Spirit and make melody and sing. That's what the church should be, filled with the Spirit. If you're going to walk, then you can walk straight and you can be intoxicated with God. It was John Wesley who said, I want a bunch of God-intoxicated men. And I can turn England upside down. God intoxicated. You see, the tragedy is that those of us who maybe never have been drunk, or if we have, it's many, many years ago, we've never really got drunk with the Lord in its place. And that leaves a kind of arid, cold, hard Christian life. And of course people will make for the pub if they want a bit of fellowship. But be filled with the Spirit and sing. And make melody in your hearts. There are three sorts of song that a Christian can sing. And Paul mentions all three. Psalms. Those are the Jewish songs. And a Christian can use them all. That's why the book of Psalms is so precious to us. Hymns, which means Christian songs composed by Christians. And we use a hymn book. And the third is a unique form. Spiritual songs. Those are songs not composed by man at all, but composed words and music by God and inspired directly by Him. I'm looking forward to the day when we may have some spiritual songs here. We had them up in the cathedral last July and they were beautiful. Singing the songs of Zion, even in a strange land. Well, this is how Christians should be. They should sing as they walk. So much for the musical side of it, but what about the words? The words are so important. Here is a lovely little text for Christian singing, and next Sunday night we've got the London Emmanuel Choir here. 80 of them will be spread about on this area here, and they'll be singing to us. How do you sing? I'll tell you how. First of all, it's got to start deep down. Christian song has got to start in the heart. Not in the mouth, not in the throat. Not even in the lungs. Got to start in the heart. You can always tell when song has started there. Making melody in your heart, that's where it starts. How far has it got to go? Well, it's got to be to God, but it's also got to be addressing one another. Do you realize that some of the hymns we sing to each other? You may have noticed that. They're not addressed to God. Most of them are, but some of the hymns we sing. Who were you singing to when you sang the last hymn? Walk in the light and thou shalt know. Who were you singing to? Not to God. You don't need to tell him to walk in the light. Who were you singing to? Yourself? No, you were singing to the person standing next to you. Walk in the light and thou shalt know. So we address one another. It starts in the heart and it reaches my next door neighbor. And we address one another. But what are the words to be about? And with this I close. Paul says, every day give thanks for everything. That gives you enough to sing about. Give thanks every day for everything. I'm quoting the New English Bible there. Every day for everything. That's enough to sing about till you're gone. The content of Christian song is to be thanksgiving. Now, I notice a contrast here. The popular songs of the 20th century are full of frustration and despair and dissatisfaction and criticism, and these are the popular songs today. And so you get a mournful song about the woes of the world, and youngsters say, isn't that a great song? It may be to them because they've learned to live in a world that is a sad world, and it speaks to the feelings they have about the world. But that's not Christian song. God may use it to stir someone up to think again, but it's not true Christian song. Christian song is song that gives thanks every day for everything. And what a difference that makes. You know, Paul said much earlier in this reading, he said, don't let your speech be filled with dirty jokes and coarse language. Rather, let your lips be filled with thanksgiving. You cannot possibly, for example, be a thankful and a covetous person at one and the same moment. It's absolutely impossible. So next time you're covetous, why not just sing a hymn of thanks and see what happens? And as our lips are filled with thanksgiving and praise, and we sing to God and thank Him for all that He is, you'll find that these other wrong things of darkness and disobedience and dissipation filter out of your minds. There's a very practical way to deal with them. Next time you're battling with them, sing a song of thanks to God and see what happens. We're going to sing a hymn now, praising my Savior all the day long. And I want you to notice while we sing it, what happens to your thoughts and feelings as we do. Blessed assurance, Jesus is mine. Number 493. 493.
Perfect delight.